forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast, now part of the Finding Genius Foundation. I have a returning guest, Doomberg. He writes a column on Substack about energy policy, pretty much worldwide. I think it's a really, really informative and fascinating article that he writes. Comes out, approximately twice a week. There's just so much great content, deep dives into how energy policy really works and the dynamics of what's going on around the world. I like to have him on the podcast and talk about, different issues, actually. So I had seen in maybe one or more of his posts where he talked about continuous improvement. I'm a big fan of that. So that's the topic for today, is how Doomberg is using continuous improvement to keep improving what they do. So welcome back, Doomberg. Thank you.
Richard, always great to speak with you. And as you mentioned, I particularly enjoy coming on your show because I know we're going to talk about different things. And as you did mention, the Doomberg team, which I'm just one member of, is hyper-focused on the concept of continuous improvement for a variety of reasons that I'm sure we'll get into.
Okay. Well, how did you first come across the concept? Did you find it as Kaizen? Did you find it as under another name? How did this come on your radar in the first place?
For me personally, I found it as my ticket out of poverty as a child, to be totally transparent, and came from rather humble beginnings and was always viscerally aware of how poor I was. And I had committed to myself as a young child / teenager, into early adulthood, that I needed to continuously improve in my skills because that was how I was going to get out. And almost to a fault, I would say, when I was a young adult, I was focused on it. But I view continuous improvement as sort of the compound interest for your skills. And that I always believed as a young person that the by far the most powerful asset I had, especially when I was poor, was the present value of my future earnings. And anything that I could do early to augment my skills would compound for the full arc of my life. So you never have more leverage to monetize a skill than when you learn it young. So I've always been fascinated by it and totally transparent. Like, I read books like Unlimited Power by Anthony Robbins growing up, and it sounds corny, but if you actually follow those things with discipline, they tend to work. Disciplined execution is still a durable moat, is one of our phrases here around the coop. And, we've made a life-changing business out of a blog, and there's a million blogs. So why did we succeed? And it's, I think, we're pretty disciplined about it, but also we have this ethos of continuous improvement, even through to today.
Yeah. I run into a lot of people that are perfectionists. That's not continuous improvement. I guess it's like I don't want to be rude to people that are perfectionists, but it's like an ineffective or twisted or cognitively unstable form of continuous improvement. Do you have any trouble with perfectionism or people you've dealt with? And how does that run into continuous improvement for you?
Actually, quite the opposite. So the difference between a perfectionist and a disciple of a continuous improvement mindset is their reaction to being wrong. We're firm believers that you can't improve until you make a mistake. And so making mistakes are, in fact, opportunities. Just take one example. Like, we built Doomberg using what we call the five pillars, and one of those five pillars is operations. And every Doomberg piece has a distinct operational plan that we follow with extreme discipline. And if something goes wrong, only two possibilities have occurred. Either you didn't follow the process, or the process is inadequate and needs to be improved. And so you can't improve without making mistakes, because how would you know what you need to do better? Whereas I would say somebody who is like an extreme perfectionist, mistakes are opportunities to beat themselves up. And so there is no such thing as perfect. I mean, people can come quite close to it, I suppose, but we are deeply humble in understanding that we have limitations as humans and as a team. And there's a difference that we can probably get into that in our sort of 2x2 matrix of continuous improvement opportunities. But To me, mistakes, we have a mistake management policy, for example. They should be rare, admitted to, corrected, and learned from. And the last of those four is what feeds the compound interest of continuous improvement of your skills over the life of your career.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed in my business, I do marketing for lawyers. That's my primary business. You know, in certain sectors, we used to have a problem every day. And then as we started systematizing and making checklists and all that, the problems went down to once a week, and then once a month, and then once a quarter. And then the severity of the problem, a lot of them would fix themselves because we were so robust with systems and everything. You know, I'd speak to the people that worked for me, and they'd say, oh, we had this problem. Wait, don't say anything. And I would be quiet, and they would say, we did this and that, we fixed it, we incorporated it into the checklist, and now it's all good. Now I'd say, oh, great. But it took quite a long time to get there.
Absolutely. And you know, prior to launching the business that eventually evolved into Doomberg, key members of the Doomberg team were pretty experienced executives at large corporations. And you can't really work in and across large bureaucracies without having pretty robust systems. Some people think that slows you down, and indeed it does. And there were ways we tried to cut through that in our time in corporate America, which, again, I'm sure we'll also get into. But I agree completely. Like, if you're focused on learning and improving, you're not really learning or improving much all the times you get it right.
How do you set the culture? You said, you know, you have a few more team members. So, you know, is it something that you have to constantly reinforce? Because I would imagine that a good percentage of people don't deal well with failure. You know, they probably have been raised where they were told it's bad. So how do you overcome that in a group and make sure that everyone rows in the same direction and has this attitude about it?
So the first thing you have to do is very, very carefully select the extraordinarily small number of people you wish to invite into your personal life, because really, if you're doing what you're meant to be doing with your life, it's deeply personal. And Doomberg is what I personally was meant to be doing, and I'm thrilled to have found it, and my plan is to just keep doing it. You can get an enormous amount of work done with a small number of people if you have this continuous improvement mindset, and most importantly, you follow the rule that we have that is like tattooed on everybody's forehead, which is, what is your get-to-have-to ratio? We have a very strong rule that you'll be extraordinarily productive if you're working on things that make you feel like you get to do them as opposed to you have to do them. And we are always auditing our calendars to measure how much of our time falls into each category and working on ways to outsource the have-tos. People are extraordinarily productive when it doesn't feel like work. And you wouldn't put somebody in a job or a task or to manage a process if it's miserable for them, if it's difficult for them to get out of bed. So I'll just give you an example. Like, we have a brilliant editor-in-chief for Doomberg, and our pieces are tight and well-edited because of that person, and they love edit day. The joke around here is when they come in on edit day, it's edit yay. Like, I get to edit this piece. That's what they like to do that.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy the researching of the pieces and stringing them together in creative ways. Now, once I hand that piece over, I'm on the next one. I forget about it. Like, and they could completely rewrite it, move things around. I take no offense. Like, that's not my job. So one of the things that I should talk about is our 2x2 matrix that we use. So you're familiar with sort of like a 2x2 matrix, standard consulting. So on the y-axis is person or team. And then on the x-axis is process and process. So you can have one person who runs a process on their own, or you can have a team that runs a process. And so where are you in that box? Are you trying to improve the person? Are you trying to improve the team? Or are you trying to improve the process that either the person or the team manages? And so we obviously try to improve ourselves. I'll give you one example. Another of our pillars, the five pillars of our business, is technology, which is all of the tools and skills we learn to run our business. And I have a goal of learning one new function on Bloomberg every week, because I do all the charting, and I'm the power user of the Bloomberg terminal here. And
So it's like cross training, you mean, for you?
Yeah, right. You know, it's what I love to do. They could charge me double what they already charge, and we would not get rid of our Bloomberg terminal. And it's just such a critical part of our work process. So that's a process that I own. So I would like to improve my Bloomberg skills, is an example of one square of that quadrant. But if you're working as a team, you asked me earlier, you know, how do you select for that in your culture? You can't have any third rails when it comes to improvement. Like, if a process is owned by a person and something went wrong, if that person is not embracing that as an opportunity to improve it, then they're not probably going to last on our team. And if we have a team dynamic, then we have a RACI chart, responsible, accountable, consulted, or informed, and everybody knows what their role is. And it's defined, like you write these things down. But you have, you know, you have to be disciplined about it, but you also have to be flexible because things don't always go correctly. So back to your whole perfectionist question. In our work process, something went wrong and it was managed by team. Let's figure out what happened and how to make sure that doesn't happen again. And after a while, it becomes second nature, like you said at your firm. Mistakes become rarer, and therefore they become easier to admit to and easier to correct, and ripe opportunities for more learning.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
Yeah, something you said is, I would express it in slightly different words, but very similar. If something goes wrong, there's only a few answers. Do we have a system for this? If so, what wasn't followed and why? If not, do we need one? Is this a one-off or is this a repeat problem? Is it very serious? But the nice thing is it reduces the possible answers to that small subset, so you can attack problems much quicker.
And by definition, you can't measure that something went wrong if everybody on the team doesn't know what success is, right? Like, we are going to get a tight piece with minimal typos that delights our existing customers and converts a few of the fence sitters. That is the objective, right? And if something goes wrong from that objective, we got a material fact wrong, or we put an image in a piece and it wasn't actually the thing we said it was, or we charted data, but we misinterpreted it and our readers pointed it out. Like, those are all opportunities to learn. And we have them, and we've made all, I mean, we've published 275 pieces, which means we had to research, write, edit, publish, and defend 275 pieces. And
oh, wow.
275 opportunities to get stuff wrong is a fair number, and you're going to get a lot wrong. It's just the way it is.
When you say defend, I imagine all of a sudden 275 PhD theses that you're standing and defending, which is pretty crazy.
Well, we have a very vibrant comments section that I think we made a very intelligent choice when we went behind the paywall, is that we limited our comment section to paying subscribers only, which means you have far less troll and far more signal. And look, if somebody wants to troll us and they're going to pay $300 a year to do it, I mean, that's, I suppose, knock yourself out. But by and large, and we police that comment section with a bit of a light touch. We really police it for civility. We're big believers that the discourse needs to change for the better, and we're going to lead by example in the tiny way that we matter. And so we have a very vibe, you know, every time we publish a piece, we probably get 200 comments. And I personally read and respond to everyone that I can. Sometimes you just like a comment because it doesn't need a response, but you want to acknowledge the person that is paying you to be in that micro social network, that you have read what they've said and you've heard them, then they're customers. Look, I mean, the customer comes first. We exist to delight our customers, that every business exists to delight their customers. And businesses that routinely delight their customers will thrive. And we are thrilled with how well Doomberg is thriving. And I do believe that objective that everybody here believes in, has bought into, and has benefited from, which is delighting our ideal customers. We stole this from Jeff Bezos. There's an old classic interview of Jeff Bezos when he was still just selling books at Amazon. And his maniacal focus on the customer is something that we watch that video every month. Like, it's just, it gives you chills. Like, yeah, this is why he's one of the richest people in the world. Let's just copy what he did, which is another thing about continuous improvement. Like, most of this has worked out. You might think Tony Robbins is kind of corny and all that stuff, but and I'm sure he is, but it's worked out. Like, just go find everybody who's ever succeeded, study them carefully, interview them if they'll let you, and copy what they do. That's a big form of flattery to these people.
Yeah, there's one, I think I've got his name right, Sir David Brailsford. He was the head of one of the Tour de France teams, and through all these incremental improvements, tiny, tiny improvements, they had won Tour de France X number of times. And so he speaks about continuous improvement He doesn't go into much detail. He gives a few examples, but I'm sure he's developed his own method and it's proprietary to him. But I just found it fascinating that he has a great example of, you know, they would change the gel that they would eat while they ride. They would change the position of the seat. They would make sure their shoes were a certain way. And they just analyzed everything in their performance down to the smallest detail and try to improve everything, even if it was a tiny gain. And the compounding of those gains help them win.
Yeah, you said something that's very interesting, which we take a slightly different approach to. I understand why he sort of treats that stuff as proprietary, but we actually proactively and enthusiastically give away every secret we have to anybody who will listen, who's interested in replicating the success that we've been able to accomplish in the blogging world. In fact, we've hosted several big name financial bloggers here in our office, just had one this week. Because we believe that giving is, you know, massively NPV positive. And if you are totally an open book with people, they will be an open book with you, and you could learn an enormous amount. And our space is growing so fast that no competitor could actually, you know, the tide is rising for everybody. And so we do have a very firm giving strategy with anybody who's polite. A big phrase that we use a lot when we interview other people, because before we launched Doomberg, we actually studied the financial newsletter industry and probably did a voice of customer with 40 successful people in the space. And the single most powerful phrase you can start a conversation with is, I need your help. It's disarming, and almost everybody will drop what they're doing and help you. Hey, I need your help. I'm thinking about making a play in a space. We'd love to understand all the things that went wrong when you launched so we could try to avoid them. And in return, we'll share with you everything that we've learned by interviewing 25 other people in this space. Do you think you could spare me 30 minutes? Starting a conversation with I need your help is just the most disarming, endearing empathy. And it's all, of course, authentic with us because we do share everything with anybody who'll come here and ask. And so we've probably had a half a dozen high-profile Substack authors through our office just in the past year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've done plenty of it, but like on this podcast, in certain industries, I've interviewed like 100 plus people, like in cancer, viruses, et cetera. And what I've learned too is if you talk to everyone you can in an industry, you make a lot of friends, you get a lot of referrals, you really get into the industry, and you can see it's like hovering over the landscape 1,000 feet up, and you see where all the players are moving, like an ant farm. Oh, this company is doing this, and this one over here, this one's doing this. And it just gives you a nice perspective of the industry. So it's great that you're doing that.
So I actually have a great thing that I used to do before Doomberg. Doomberg has sort of changed a lot about my life and the lives of the other team members because we're on this treadmill. You said we publish roughly 2 times a week, and that's right. And we have a firm belief that we never allow our customers to know that we're on vacation. Like, we publish 2 times a week, every week. And if we have to write 3 or 4 in advance so we can take spring break, we're still going to be policing the comment section and all that stuff. So it's changed my life. But back in my corporate days, I was a scientist by training, and I'd led large teams of scientists throughout my career as I grew up the corporate ladder. The one thing I did every year is I would go to a conference completely out of my field, and I would have a goal. So if your objective is you want to sort of network in a field, then the way I always work is I try to convert that into sort of SMART goals with sort of measurable definitions of success. And I would always say, My definition of success for this random conference that I would go to is I'm going to hand out 25 business cards during the various poster sessions. What does that mean? Well, in order to hand out a business card, you have to have a meaningful conversation with somebody. And how do you have a meaningful conversation with somebody? Well, you show interest in what they're doing, and you go in and you try to learn. And so I would bring 25 business cards to a conference, and I wouldn't leave until they were all handed out. And I have the same approach, I think, as you do with sort of, as a host of a podcast, you're automatically sort of getting networked. I would do it on purpose. And I've learned an enormous amount. In fact, I went to very, very large cancer conferences myself for an important personal reason in my life. And I've since become quite obsessed with cancer, and I'm pretty well connected in this space as well.
Do you study and incorporate the 80-20 rule in what you do in your optimization?
Yeah, the Pareto chart is pretty standard, but this gets back to the get-to-have-to ratio that I mentioned earlier. We don't take scheduled meetings, for example. The only meetings on our calendar basically are podcast appearances, which are because they have to be recorded at a certain time, and they're not really work. I feel like I get to do this. I was looking forward to this conversation today, by the way.
Thanks.
And travel. So, you know, you have to write those down when you're not going to be around, right? But we literally take 0 meetings. And so all of our time is spent on the things that we feel like we get to do, and we assemble the team who feel like they get to do at least one part of our critical work process. And then you only do that. You only do things you feel like you get to do. So, for example, I do all my writing between 2 and 5 a.m. and handed a piece to the editor-in-chief this morning. And then I got to be on the internet all day researching and thinking about the next piece. I had no meetings other than this. Literally, this is the only thing on my calendar in the past 72 hours.
Oh, wow.
Formally.
That better be good then.
It's been great. Of course, I knew it would be. But that's why I accepted it. But my point is, think of how productive you are. If 80% of your work gets done in 20% of your time, actually, I should say, it's funny. When we started our consulting firm, when the group of executives who ultimately quit their jobs and created this bespoke consulting firm that after we lost all our business in COVID, we reinvented ourselves by consulting in the content creator space, and then ultimately Doomberg was born out of that. Our original value proposition was we produce all of our value in 20% of our time. A company pays us 100 units of value basically for that 20% because the other 80 are wasted. What if we shot just that 20%, the stuff we love to do that's actually productive, to other executives that we know in the industry and charge them 40 units of value for it, but sell it 5 times each? And we could double our salaries, our compensation packages, and only do what we love. Now that business is constrained because you're selling time, not scaling time, but it worked. Like we did that. We packaged the things we love to do, all of the value that we created in the 20% of our time. And we just sold that as a consulting product to other executives who were looking to climb the corporate ladder. Pitch was quite simple. Like, the collective brains of all of us plus you gets expressed through you. Your boss doesn't even know we exist because you're using your company's money to hire external consultants anyway, and companies want their executives to get better. And so it was a very good idea that worked. And so the 80-20 rule was actually the foundation of the very first business that we did, which we would probably still be doing if it wasn't for COVID-19.
The nice thing I found about 80-20 is that I know it exists everywhere. All I have to do is find it. But the knowing that it's going to be there in a list of customers or in activities that have impact, it makes me feel so much better, because again, all I have to do is find it. And if I keep capitalizing on it, things improve really quickly.
100%. It is a universal truism. It's quite remarkable. And we do incorporate that into our thinking all the time.
So what are some of the specific, micro or macro improvements that you've made, in doing your articles and running Doomberg that had a really positive effect?
We've done a lot of experimenting. So we have a phrase around here that if it can be measured, it can be optimized. And the data will tell you, like, as long as you have the authentic desire to learn, like, or this piece didn't land, why? What was different about this piece versus the last 5 that did land? How are we measuring whether it landed? Is that the correct measurement? So, for example, before we wrote Doomberg as a completely free publication for a year, and we grew beyond our wildest imaginations when we started, and we realized that we had something potentially significant brewing. Right place, right time. We came of age during the energy crisis. It happened to be that we could provide the industry voice to the energy debate that has been missing. When we went to paid, we were given 2 pieces of advice that were catastrophically wrong that we didn't follow. One was that we should charge a relatively de minimis amount so that we could make it up in volume. That would have been a big mistake. And the second is that we should do the freemium model where, most of your stuff is free and only some of the things are behind the paywall. We had learned through experience that 90% of people who consume content will never pay for content because there's so much free stuff out there that they would rather pay nothing to anybody and consume 90% of it, but 10% of people will pay you. And you should listen to those voices on pricing. So when we first announced our price, it was relatively high for Substack. Since then, virtually every other finance Substack has a higher price than us because they've seen that the market actually can absorb. The value for value conversation happens at a higher price than $5 a month, which was sort of the standard advice that you get when you start a Substack. It basically make it a tipping feature. Tipping businesses don't work well. We priced ourselves at $30 a month, and now you can only get us at $300 a year. We've even closed monthly subscribers because we are interested in finding the subset of the 10% of the people that value our work. And on the how much should be free and how much should be paid, we landed on, after much experimentation, that the first one third of our article will be free to everybody. But if you want to read the rest of it, you have to become a paying subscriber because, you know, we do a lot of work and people will pay for valuable work. And if our work is invaluable, by the way, the market will tell us. So, and that sort of one third of every article free as opposed to one out of every three articles free is a huge difference in conversion. And this is a churn business. I mean, you lose a certain amount of your subscribers, and in order to tread water, you have to replace them. And that means you have to be continuously replacing them because you're continuously losing them. And so understanding those two things, those were the big sort of things we learned by talking to 40 content creators and seeing who was successful and who wasn't and trying to understand why and so on.
It's smart that you guys do the one price for the year, because then once you collect that, now that you're going to slack off, you don't have to spend time every month, oh no, I hope this person doesn't quit. Oh no, we had 12 quitters this month. Oh no, we got, you know, it kind of takes you off the treadmill a bit. So I see why you're quitting. It's a good idea.
Well, also, I mean, at our scale, you know, you don't have time. I mean, we try our best. Look, we answer every comment. We personally answer every email. We are trying to be as high touch as we can. But if you have thousands and thousands of customers, just, you know, there's only so much that you can do for any particular one of them. So then you have to think about the sort of the numbers game. But in reality, another thing we've done is we've done a lot of deep dives on who our customers are. And the vast majority of our customers are relatively price agnostic. They just want quality. This is why we don't like run ads, for example, in our newsletter, which is another way we could monetize our audience. Our ideal clients don't want to see ads. The very first thing we did, which I suppose I should have said from the start, is we wrote deep character sketches of our ideal clients and how do we delight them. Like, our ideal client is not a value buyer. There's plenty of great businesses for whom their ideal clients are valued buyers, at Walmart, for example. That's not our product. We're a premium product, and we better deliver against that promise. If we don't, we will lose the churn war. But our ideal clients don't want to see ads, don't want to, they're not participating in the Twitter wars, for example, because they don't want to be mucked up. Like, they want to have intelligent conversations with relatively like-minded people from whom they can learn. And we actively seek to delight our ideal clients. We wrote detailed character sketches of who our ideal clients are, and we went and targeted them.
No, your publication, I mean, I think it's totally worth it. The level of writing is very high. And I feel like, you know, online I'm wading through garbage, you know, knee-high garbage with most of the articles, and now it's AI, it's even worse. But when you see a quality publication, you know. And whenever I look for your guys' emails when they come into my inbox, and I forward them and I star them, you know, to be read and all that. But I value them very highly, first because I'm paying, second of all, because I have confidence every time it's going to be a well-written article. No worries that it's going to be low quality, which is nice.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that. You know, our brand ambition, brand is one of the five pillars. And I keep mentioning the five pillars, but we could probably talk about them as a whole conversation here. But brand is one of the five pillars. And after we had created our character sketches of our ideal clients, we said, what is the brand of Doomberg? So a brand is a gut feeling. It's the gut feeling you induce in your ideal clients when they interact with your product. And we actually wrote down, what gut feeling would we like to induce in Richard Jacob? Well, here is the gut feeling we targeted, and you just articulated. When our email shows up in their inbox, the gut feeling we induce in Richard is, ooh, I get to read that.
Yep.
In our mind, three really important things that would most likely induce that. One is we need to be provocative without being polarized. So we need to make you think different. But we don't want to just indulge in engagement harvesting. Two, we should be funny without being silly. There's always a little dry sense of humor in a Doomberg piece. We want to make you laugh at least once. This is why the captions to our pictures are so important, by the way. You'll notice there's a lot of subtle humor embedded in those captions. We think about those a lot. If it can be measured, it can be optimized. And then three, we should teach without being self-indulgent. So a successful Doomberg piece makes you think differently about a problem, teaches you something, and makes you laugh at least. And if we deliver against that every single time, we will experience the renewal rates that we are and the size of the business we've been able to grow it to and all of those wonderful rewards. And nobody wants a deal on a Rolex. Like, that, if you're in the premium product space, A, you have to deliver a premium product, and B, you have to price it accordingly. If we had priced it at a third of the current price, we'd have less subscribers than we do. I believe that firmly. And so again, like, there's nothing wrong with any of the business models that are successful. You just have to know which one you're in. And then finally, because we are producing a premium product that has nothing to do with AI, and you expect something interesting and funny and insightful every time we send an article out, our view is we don't press send unless we think it could be the very best article we've ever written. We just don't put out garbage. We don't put out garbage. And we try really hard enough. Not every piece will be in that category, but we believe it is when we hit send, or we wouldn't publish it. This is why we don't publish to a fixed schedule. Even though we publish at a pretty regular cadence, we've written pieces that we've not published. Like now, the editor will look at me and say, this is, nah, let's put it, make a ball out of that piece of paper and toss it back at me and say, do better. Write something else.
Does that happen often, or are you in a groove where it rarely happens?
5 times out of 275, I'd say. I'm looking over at the editor now, getting the nod. That's probably about the number of that. But look, I mean, I'd never take offense to it. I don't want to put out garbage. Oh, well, another really important thing, you know, I have a science background and a lot of our pieces are science-y, right? The editor comes from more of a finance private equity background. And our rule is if the editor doesn't understand it, our ideal customer is not going to understand it. So I got to write it with more clarity. So in a sense, the editor is one of our ideal clients too. I have to write it in a way that makes sense to them.
You know, something that I thought about is, the concept of paying attention. I realize people are literally paying you with their attention. So if you look at your $300 a year subscription fee, and then you look at the attention you garner from what you produce, what is the value of the attention versus the revenue you're getting from the person? Like, is that something useful to think about?
Well, actually, we said a slightly different way. It is our view that cash flow of this business, as much as it's thrilling, is perhaps the least valuable aspect of it. We have an enormous list of email address of literal who's who of successful people, both in industry and Wall Street. And then a significant subset of those have raised their hand to say they value our work enough to have paid for it. And then we have our pro tier, which is $1,200 a year. And if we sort of just peruse that list of people who subscribe to that tier, it's, you know, a very, very valuable list of names and the contacts we've made. So for example, the pieces benefit from what we call the network effect. We have so many experts in our database, subscribers, free, paid, pro, that love the fact that we are free to articulate the industry voice. And they can't because they're trapped behind a wall of public affairs professionals who are hyper-vigilant about not getting canceled. Mm-hmm. And so they send us great ideas that they hope we would write about. And conversely, they volunteer to be off-the-record experts for us to consult with and run things by so that we don't publish something that is like blatantly erroneous. And the dozens and dozens of different topic areas that we've actually written on, we've not yet made all that many meaningful mistakes. And when we do, we just admit it. Like we just write it, send it out to our full list and say, we got this wrong and here's why. But by and large, we have a pretty good hit rate. You know, each piece probably has 30 to 40 statements of fact in it. And rare is a piece where we get a statement of fact wrong. But when it does get wrong, it gets pointed out to us either in the comments or via email, and we immediately correct it. But we have this network effect. Ideas are always coming in. And then we've kept sort of a log of who gave us good ideas and what their expertise was so that if we ever want to return to that topic, we know who to reach out to.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So it's kind of like when you have 225,000 emails in your database and people know that every single email they sent us, the paid subscribers, we can't respond to everybody, but we respond to 100% of paid subscribers and most of the free who send us notes. But every single paid subscriber gets a response.
It'll be funny. There's a DJ named Marshmello. For a while, no one knew who he was. He had this like marshmallow thing over his head. It'd be funny if you guys had a party and you had the chicken masks on and, you know, you guys went to the party and you had voice changers. And so you could be there with people in person, your subscribers, but it still would be the mystery of who you are.
Well, actually, hundreds of people know who we are. Like, for example, all these content creators who come visit us obviously know who we are. We meet them at the airport and they stay at the local hotel and they spend the day, you know, at our office with us. And with mostly anonymity for brand preservation at this point. I mean, we started anonymous mostly because we had no presence on social media. And as you probably know, the first rule of marketing is you can't be remembered if you don't stand out. And, you know, my distinctly average looking face would not have made the impression on Twitter that the green chicken did when Twitter was one of the primary growth drivers for us. We've since left Twitter for a variety of reasons. But now that we've created it, as you say, the brand mystique is really important. And it would be popped if we sort of came out as our regular selves, so to speak. And so that's the primary reason why we keep it. But if you sent us an email saying, hey, I I'd love to come visit you. We would reveal ourselves to you and host you.
That's cool. That's great. That's really, really neat. In regards to the continuous improvement, are you, you know, is your organization hitting like serious diminishing returns? Have you optimized to such a point where now you're going for just little improvements, or is there still tons more that you can do?
There's always more that you can do. And by the way, Doomberg won't be the last business we build together. We're builders. We view ourselves as sort of CEOs with an exit behind us now that Doomberg has been so successful and publicly so. And so we'll always keep Doomberg going. And we're beginning to expand the team ever so slightly so that we can take some of the burden off of the founders in a way that doesn't, you know, that improves the quality, doesn't detract from it. It's the work of my life. It's not the work of all the lives of the people on the team. And then we'd like to free some of them up to pursue their own passions and to help them as well. And so there's never, you know, the only thing that happens as you get older is that the leverage of the return on improvement diminishes because you just have less time. But the desire and joy that one gets from improving and solving problems that used to be unsolvable to you, or, you know, cracking certain challenges, is truly, you know, it's the human endeavor, right? I mean,
have there been any, you know, challenges that, I don't know, are some of the most difficult, or ones that, you know, the continuous improvement solved and you're really totally surprised by it? It wasn't deliberate?
Oh boy, it's a good question. Again, we have a very distorted view of average here. And so I think such problems present themselves when we are forced to interact with a wider audience that doesn't have the same mindset. If you carefully select and curate and optimize your micro environment, sometimes when you go out into the macro, it can be a struggle. You know, we live in a world where you can work remotely and you could build an online business like we have from anywhere. And frankly, we live in rural America and fly over country, very nice small town, and have worked and invested in our micro environments to make them as pleasant, enjoyable, and frankly, suitable for creative endeavors as possible. We would never skimp on investing in our local environments to optimize that get-to feeling. And so the real challenges arise when you, if I go to New York, for example, I'm just overwhelmed by the chaos and the noise and the impact it has on my mindset and so on. And so it's just a different experience, right? And so if you surround yourself with only high performers who are mission aligned and care deeply about the one goal that everyone on the team cares deeply about, then in fact, the real challenges arise when you take yourself out of that environment. And so, and a lot of that actually happened with COVID. You know, we ran a very small multifamily quarantine where we had, you know, an office that only these families could access, and we kept everything together and kept our business going, even though we lost 85% of our revenue in the span of 6 weeks, like many other small business owners. We call that a high pucker factor moment, by the way. We focused on, you know, continuous improvement and relying on each other and team and all of that stuff. But when we deviate from this curated inner circle, it can be actually difficult to operate. And I find myself less capable of doing that.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, yeah, I wonder what percentage of businesses are really actively trying to continuously improve, and which one, you know, what percentages exist. And, you know, maybe it's unfair, but seems like, I don't know, 90% of businesses and people don't do this continuous optimization. When you do, and when it's so inculcated what you do, yeah, it would be shocking and disappointing, I guess, to interact with the majority of people that don't.
Yeah, and again, it's no insult to them. I mean, they're living in their own world and trying to get by. But to your point, like, the vast majority of small businesses fail, right? I mean, that's just numerically speaking. And the ones that persist almost always subsidize their customers, and the owners don't actually earn a living wage if you actually factor out the true expenses of their time. This is the curse of small businesses. Like, the local dry cleaner or coffee shop, the owner is working 100 hours a week, right? And the business is not sellable because it wouldn't make money if they paid themselves a real salary commensurate with the work they're doing. And so that's just a fact of the vast majority of small businesses. And so if you're subsidizing your customers and it's, you know, your main priority is making sure that your employees' wages are covered, then there's not going to be much left for you, the owner. And that is the market telling you that either you're pricing your product incorrectly or you don't have a sufficiently differentiated one.
Well, I see two kinds of business. I see, you know, like the let's say restaurants. So there's the corporate-owned ones that do appear to have more systems, uniforms, and all that stuff. But their product is, you know, It's just for the masses. And then there's like the mom and pop places that don't have systems. They may have delicious food, but for some reason they're not in that mindset. So both suffer, but in a different way. It's hard to find someone that does both.
I would argue the small mom and pop shops that make delicious meals, the primary thing they do is they price their product wrong. They subsidize their customers. If you truly make ultra delicious food, raise your price. People will pay for it. Value for value. This is where, you know, when we launched Umber as the paid product, we got an avalanche of hate mail on our price. Like an avalanche of hate mail. And we knew from other experience and studying other people's data that, you know, these people said, well, if you did $10 a month, I would happily pay. No, they wouldn't. If we'd have done $10 a month, they would have said they would pay at $5. And if we would have priced it at $5, they just wouldn't have paid, but wouldn't complain as loudly as they did. Imagine what the mentality it takes to take to your email and to write a scolding email to an entrepreneur building a business that their price is too low. So I think what happens is most restaurants who make great food listen to those people and not the 10% of the people that are happy to pay for value because they want to see you succeed. So it could be that my view is just colored by our direct and visceral experience, but we predicted the avalanche of hate that came and we still succeeded, right? Like there was enough people that were happy to pay for our product. And in fact, we get, you know, commentary that perhaps we're too cheap. If you look at the top 10 finance substacks on the paid leaderboard, I believe the median price now is $45 a month. So even though we're number one by a wide margin, we are actually in sort of the bottom quartile of the best finance substacks as it pertains to pricing. Now, we've set one price 2 years ago and have not changed it. And others have seen that you can, in fact, charge for value if you produce a good product. And so they've been able to climb the leaderboard at a higher price because to the investor on Wall Street who reads Doomberg because they like our insights and we teach them a few things, like they're putting it on their work card and they, you know, $300 a year is a deal for them. So, but at that price and where we live and the lifestyles we have, that's a very fair price for us too. And so, but you know, the diner that makes great food but doesn't have systems, the systems are important, but actually it's the price. It's just price. It's always price. Go back to price. This is the number one thing. Like when we studied all the content creators, the people who made the most money charge the most. It's a straight line. Straight line.
Well, you said that's not your only focus, right? So,
yeah. I mean,
where you are, things are going well. It's okay. You don't need to get every penny.
Correct. I mean, if we wanted to get every penny, there's other things we could do. But we've talked about this as well as a team because is money truly the thing we're trying to optimize? Like once you have way more than enough, what's the incremental return on more?
Right. Exactly.
In fact, at that point, more becomes, you know, the chase for more becomes a disease. We wrote a piece on this, one of our Work of Our Life pieces, where we quoted David Berman, who unfortunately killed himself because he was, you know, suffered with depression his whole life. A brilliant musician, Silver Jews, and Purple Mountain. One of our favorite songs, and the title of that piece was Strange Victory. One of our favorite songs of his is Strange Victory, Strange Defeat. And we prefer to just focus on the first half of that title. But the lyric from that song is how much fun is a lot more fun, not much fun at all, right? And it's one of those lines that sticks with you. And the strange victory, strange defeat that he was referring to is the fact that, you know, he was an indie rock legend amongst other indie rock aficionados. But when indie rock went mainstream, the strange victory, his band, the Silver Jews, was not given the recognition that he felt it deserved, i.e. the strange defeat. And the title of our piece was Strange Victory, because like Doomberg has made amazing success relative to our expectations, a mind-blowing success. We're going to focus on that. Like we're not going to focus on, wow, why aren't we tripling from here? Or, you know, we'd like to make more money, but we want to do it in a way that's on brand. And we want to do it in a way that actually satisfies the ultimate mission, which is we want to wake up every day, to quote Jim Harbaugh, ready to intact today with an enthusiasm unknown to mankind. And you can only do that if you love what you do and you have a high get-to-have-to ratio and you don't have any scheduled meeting and you're focusing all your time on the 20% and you're outsourcing the 80%. All the things we've talked about today, we live. And that's way more important than 25% more money when I have four times as much as I could ever imagine needing.
That's great. One thing that's coming across to me is, you know, you and your team need to be mentally strong. Anyone that does this continuous improvement, you have to face your own failures over and over and over again. I think a lot of people are not willing to do that. And when you make big decisions like you did with going behind the paywall, and like you said, you got an avalanche of hate mail, a lot of people would would say, oh no, and maybe apologize and crumble. So I guess mentally, you guys have to be tough in order to just keep doing this over and over and over, even though the rewards are great. How do you manage that?
I mean, you can't be a person on the internet without having a good shield towards hate, right? I mean, it's just, especially since we grew our business on Twitter, you know, so we had these great, we produced these great coffee mugs early on before we went to paid. And the editor is also a brilliant copywriter, and they wrote some brilliant copy on doomberg.myshopify.com if you want to go read the copy. And one of the mugs that we sold was the Totally Agree mug. And where does that come from? That comes from when we were growing on Twitter, and Twitter's successful. I mean, Twitter's great. It's amazing. It's real time. It's successful. And there's all manner of people there looking to drag anybody else who's had any semblance of success down. And if you listen to those people, if your consciousness, if your, you know, if your mental state is flypaper instead of Teflon, then the things that people throw at you will affect your mental state. We try to have Teflon mental states. But when somebody would write a nasty comment under one of our tweets, you know, we would post a piece. You got this wrong, and this is nonsense, and this is BS, and you guys are hacks, and blah, 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 blah. Our standard reply would be, totally agree. Totally agree.
And then what would that take the air out of their
complaint? It would make me laugh. Most importantly, it would make our subscribers who were in on the joke laugh. And so we one of the mugs that we sold was the Totally Agree mug. And, you know, the copy for it is just brilliant. And by the way, the copy is something that our ideal clients would resonate with. And so I'm actually going to pull it up and read it to you. Get it?
Sure.
Typing up the page right now. Yeah, let's see the Totally Agree mug. So this is, you know, when your editor can write this beautifully, you know that you're going to have great pieces. So here it is. This is the copy for the Totally Agree mug. You can see the proverbial cliff this project is about to fall off, as the new boss fires out email after email of executive decisions with a convoluted inefficiency known only to the most pedigreed of the managerial class. The cascade of directives lay waste to each practical course of action you've advocated for. This is going to get ugly. You smirk, taking a sip of dark roast from your new Doomberg mug. Reply all, colon, totally agree. Durable ceramic mug and standard 11-ounce scratch-resistant construction, blah, 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 blah. It's the Totally Agree mug, right? This is how we would respond to trolls. So when somebody would write us a nasty note saying how we're nowhere near worth $30 a month and $1,200 a month for your pro tier, who do you people think you are? We would just reply, totally agree.
And what happens when you would do that? Would people respond and get even madder, or would it just stop them dead?
95% the latter, and the 5% the former, we would just continue to have fun with. I mean, life's too short to worry about the trolls. And again, like we say, if you're willing to pay us $300 a year to troll us in our comments, then knock yourself out. We'll take it.
That's hilarious. Well, excellent. Excellent, Doomberg. This has been a great call. It really has. And I know you guys are just, you've achieved this state of zen in business. It feels like, you know, speaking to you, it's like, it's going to be okay. And, you know, if you do this and that, you'll have this, things will go well. So, it's actually soothing to hear what you're doing.
One of our big experiences, we manage by expressions, right? And expressions are useful, like memes. There's always a bad life can be. Like reflecting on where we are as a team from the post-COVID lows. I mean, if you can't be happy with this amount of success, then what's the point? You know, like, and so I intend to be happy. Our ideal customers know how thrilled we are to have their business. Like you, Richard, should know that we value the fact that you pay for our work, and we're going to respond accordingly. And as long as there's enough Richards in the world, who cares about what anybody else is? Life's too short. Like, by the time, on my tombstone, and I'll leave this with you, I want it to be said that he lived well.
Excellent. Well, Doomberg, thanks again for coming. Where can, it's obvious, but I want you to say anyway, where can people find your publication and subscribe to it if they wish?
Actually, it's not quite obvious because we've recently ejected the squatter from doomberg.com, and now we own it, and that's where you can find all of our work. It wasn't a cheap ejection, but it was worth more to us than we ended up paying for it. So newsletter.doomberg.com. We're still affiliated with Substack. It all goes through Substack, but we wanted to own our own domain name. Doomberg.com will get you there, but we are on Substack. That's where you find everything. Our podcast appearances like this one, our newsletter, our pro tier, and so on. And Richard, look, it was absolutely fantastic. I always know that when you send us an email inviting us to come on, it's going to be a great discussion, and this certainly was no different.
Well, thank you. It's good to talk to you again.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.